Section, National Council of Jewish Women, April 6, 1992. This is Judith Ross here with Shirley Stolzer interviewing Gertrude F. Kaplan. Gertrude, would you please state your name and address?
Thank you, Judy. I'm Gertrude F. Kaplan, 552 North Neville Street, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 15213.
Gertrude, at the end of our last interview, unfortunately, we ran out of tape, which is one of the reasons why we're back today. And you had begun to relate to us, upon my request, a couple of outstanding stories in your trips with your husband as physician of the Pittsburgh Symphony. What I'd like to do is pick up where we left off there, because two of the stories did not get recorded.
I see.
The one, Hong Kong and Austria,
uh-huh.
And I'm sure there are more. Uh-huh. But also, if you would please give us a little background information as to when that occurred in your lives and what that was all about.
Thank you. Yes, I'll try to recall. The Hong Kong episode was the trip with the symphony, I would say, in the late 70s. This may have been 1978 or 79. I'm not positive, but that doesn't necessarily matter. What is interesting is that the then Consul General to Hong Kong was the Honorable Burton Levin, L-E-V-I-N. He was not an ambassador, but he was indeed our highest emissary from the state capital, from the State Department. And just yesterday, on Meet the Press, or one of our national programs, there was the Honorable Burton Levin, whom we'd lost track of. We tried to find him when we were in Hong Kong ourselves, and we were told he's no longer in that capacity. And he was being quoted in regard to our relationships with China and China's changing economic political scene and so forth. He is apparently the director of the Asia International Economic Corporation, or that sort of thing. I didn't quite get his title. I was so excited when I saw the name. We were invited, as were the maestro and several of the principal players, to an embassy reception on Victoria Hill in Hong Kong after one of our concerts. And I vividly recall the evening. It was a torrential downpour. We went on our bus and got off and were escorted under big umbrellas. It was then that I realized that our embassies have a very unique exchange program with the Museum of Modern Art that I didn't know about. The hangings throughout the home were magnificent and obviously renowned artists, both deceased and living, were on display. And I asked how each of our embassies managed to acquire such fantastic art collections, and was told that this is a procedure of rental with the Museum of Modern Art throughout the world. Mm-hmm. So the Picassos and the Rauschenbergs and the Monets, whatever, you know. At any rate, we went through the receiving line, and it was obvious that the that Ambassador Levin, I'll call him that, Levin's wife was a Chinese lady, and her name was Lily. And we met Mrs. Levin, who was quite adorable and stopped me and personalized our meeting immediately by saying, "Oh, I love your top. I was wearing one of the new beaten tops. Did you get it here?" And I said, "No, as a matter of fact, I got it at Saks Fifth Avenue in Pittsburgh, but it may well have been made in Hong Kong, you know." So she sort of identified me. We went through the line. There were, I would say, over 100 people at this lovely large buffet supper. And I went to the buffet table and observed many what appeared to be Yiddish dishes. Gefilte fish balls were being passed. There was pate, which looked like either chopped liver or chicken livers. There were little knishes, and I was very aware of this. At one point, I was chatting with Ambassador Levin, and I said, "Ambassador Levin, do I detect some very ethnic cooking?" You know, I was being gingerly here. And he said, "Oh, you must call me Bert." That's how I learned his name was Bert. And I said, well, I get a little reluctant. He said, please call me Bert. I said, all right, Bert, then call me Gert. And that, too, sort of solidified our more personal relationship. He said, you know, you're very right. I met Lily in New York when she was a student at Hunter College. And Lily came to our home frequently and learned how to cook from my mother. And indeed, Lily does much in the way of Jewish cooking. In fact, he said, she just put out a cookbook. I said, oh, did she really? I'd love to see it. In fact, I'd like to have one. So he called Lily over. And remind me, I think I found a copy of that. I thought I'd given them all away, but I found one. And he called Lily over and said, Mrs. Gertrude Gert wants to buy a cookbook. And, oh, she was delighted. It was for the benefit of the Boys Club of Hong Kong. And in those days, I think the cookbook was $5.95. So I turned to Paul and I said, darling, please pay Lily. And Paul took a $10 bill out of his wallet. And she said, oh, I'll autograph it for you and I'll go and get change. And I put a restraining hand on her arm and I said, Lily, Paul is used to not getting change when he gives and buys for charity. I said, no change, you keep the change. She said, you're wonderful, would you help me dispose of some of these? So it ended up that Paul and I took about 25 back to the hotel and sold them, and whatever was left over the symphony had to dispose of. But they were lovely and did indeed say, please, when you come back, get in touch with us. Well, we did try to reach them, and as I indicated to you, they had been transferred. We had another very interesting episode, actually in Europe. And this was at the embassy in Austria, Vienna, where again we were invited after concert. The ambassador was Milton Wolf, a Jewish, successful Jewish businessman from Cleveland, who had been a strong supporter of President Jimmy Carter. And this was a Carter appointee. And his wife was Rosalind, and she was a Ratner from the famous Ratner family in Cleveland. Very huge philanthropic family. And Milton Wolf and Rosalind were lovely. And would you believe they were keeping or attempting to keep a kosher home at the embassy in Vienna, Austria? This was incredible. She had a strictly kashrut buffet, tuna and egg salad and herring and so forth and so on. And I said, how do you do it, Roz? She was lovely and warm, and she and I, in fact, we have some pictures together. And she said, it's not easy, but I've managed to do it. I found a kosher butcher, and I do get kosher meat. And we kashrut the kitchen and so forth. That was a lovely, interesting experience. The next time we went to that embassy, this is fascinating, the ambassador and his wife were from Indiana. And I remember saying, oh, how interesting. We had a daughter who went to the University of Indiana. She was a dance major. And the ambassador got very excited. And he called his wife over and he said, our daughter went to the University of Indiana. She was a dance major. Talk about a small world story. Our children knew each other. They knew each other. I found that out when we came back. They were very gracious. Now, a very fascinating thing happened at the in Bonn, at the German embassy, where the appointee, I do believe at that time, was, again, a Jewish ambassador from Los Angeles, whose name eludes me, but he was very ill. And in his absence, the charge d'affaires, Saul Polonsky and his wife Gladys invited us. These invitations came very formally, you know, to the reception. And we went through the receiving line, and this was a huge bear of a man. I say a bear of a man. He was very hirsute. He had a heavy beard and heavy head of hair, and he was a big man, and his wife was a tiny little southern lady. And we could see that this had been a mixed marriage, you know. And he was very cordial. They were very gracious. At the end of the evening, and here again there were over 100 people, as we left, again, we don't know what to call them, so we call them Ambassador Polonsky, took Paul's hand and said, it was a pleasure having you here and meeting you this evening, Dr. Kaplan. So Paul said, I'm really impressed. This is incredible. You met so many people this evening and you remembered my name. And Mr. Polonsky said, Doctor, some names I remember, which we thought very significant. That evening was fascinating because, did I say that was Germany?
Yeah.
No, that was not. That was Austria. That was also Vienna. The reason I know that is that evening we met an ambassador by the name of Eugene Douglas, an appointee of Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, as ambassador at large for refugees. I didn't know we had such an ambassador. I'm not so sure that we still do. But this was an absolutely brilliant man who had just come from Japan. He was dealing with the whole worldwide problem of refugees, not just Jewish. And he was trying to raise money for the world to help support refugees in transition and in camps. And he was talking about how utterly indifferent to this problem Japan was. He finally eked out some modest millions, he told us, from them. He said the European community was less than generous. That really worldwide it was always America who was out with the money to support people in trouble and refugees worldwide. Ambassador Douglas was a delightful man. We had supper with him and he said to us, would you like to meet with a woman who's here as the head of the Jewish agency at the, you know, Vienna was the staging area where our Jewish people from Russia at that time getting out in dribbles and drabbles, but would come through any of Eastern Europe, that Romania, Lithuania, wherever they came through, they came to Vienna for the absorption center. That's what I was groping for before going on to Israel or the United States. And he said, would you like to meet with this lady? Unfortunately, this was a Friday night and we couldn't go to the absorption center itself Saturday, but Ambassador Douglas did arrange for her to come to our hotel and we did have a few hours of a meeting with them. She came with her husband and with another Israeli gentleman whom she introduced as her treasurer of the Jewish agency. But Paul and I were convinced he was a very husky, very burly man. He didn't have much to say. And we could tell by his demeanor, he was her bodyguard. He was absolutely her bodyguard. We went to a cafe. He looked around before we sat down at a table. He was ever on the alert. And she told us that the amount of anti-Semitism that still exists in Vienna is so flagrant. She said, you know, to that day, Jews were still being identified with the big J for Jew on their visas or their passports. She knew to the number exactly how many Jews there were in Vienna and how many Jews there were in Austria. She knew to the last count. And she was, this is all before Waldheim, you know, it's interesting. And she was still so very aware of the really not very veiled anti-Semitism. Speaking of which, let me recount a story. I hadn't thought about it till this moment
for
years.
Do you know her name?
I don't remember her name. Will you forgive me?
Sure.
I'm reminded of a very disheartening, whether it was anti-Semitism or anti-Americanism, encounter that I had in Stuttgart, Germany. Paul was not with me. When we arrived in Stuttgart on one of our trips, Paul went off with Tom Fay. Tom Fay was an oboe player who was into all kinds of toys and trains for his kids, and they have an outstanding train, electric train for children called the Markel, M-A-R-K-E-L. And Tom was going off and Paul went with him to buy some for our grandsons. I was with two of the violinists who, you know, they said, where are you going for lunch, Gert? And I said, I don't know, somewhere close to the hotel. We get in late, you know, and the hotel is closed frequently. These were Stuart Discount and Ken Linge. Ken retired before Stuart. Stuart retired last year. Both violinists, old guard players in the symphony. Very nice fellows. Lots of fun. And so the three of us began to stroll down the street. Now, the concierge said to us at the hotel, because we said, where can we get a bite of lunch? He said, well, anywhere down the street, but don't go into the corner bar. It's really kind of rough. It's more a saloon. You don't want to eat there. Just go beyond there. So we meandered down, and we see a menu on the coffee shop window, and the menu says in German, Spargel. Do you know what Spargel are? They're these wonderful foot-long white asparagus. Spargel or asparagus. And I said to Stuart, oh, that would be lovely for change. And he said, oh, I would like an omelette. I don't want Saubrauten, and I don't want Knackwurst, and I don't want heavy meat Wurst. And, you know, they eat heavy and a lot of pork and beef and meat. And I said, that's fine. So we walk in, and we see a few of the symphony players finishing lunch. And we walk toward the back to greet a few of them. And as we're standing there chatting, a waiter approaches us. Now, this is about 10 to 2 in the afternoon. I remember it vividly. And Stuart says to him, do you have omelette? And I said, oh, and do you have Spargel? And, you know, your sign said we do. And he turned to us and said, this restaurant is closed. And people were eating. And we said, well, it said, you know, till 2 or 2:30 or whatever it said on the... This, we have no omelette, we have no Spargel. This restaurant is closed. Well, we weren't going to argue with him, though it seemed a little strange. He said, I tell you where you can go. You go out the door and you turn left, and on the corner, there is a restaurant. So we get to the door, and I said to the two men, you know, that's the restaurant the concierge told us not to go to. So instead of turning left, we turn right. And a few hundred yards down, we see another coffee shop, and we see a menu again, and we go in, and they're serving, and again, some of our symphony people are finishing lunch. We sit down. They were very busy. We were leisurely. They had omelette, mushroom omelette, they had Spargel, all the things we wanted. I remember, lovely pink-cheeked adolescent young man took our order, very, very Aryan-looking, but very cordial and knew what we were ordering. And we were eating. Now, this means there's a lapse of at least an hour since we were in the first restaurant. An hour, maybe an hour and a half. And all of a sudden, literally as though through the wall, in comes this waiter who had sent us out of the other restaurant. And he sees the three of us eating, and he comes over to the table, and he is absolutely frustrated and angry, and he shouts at us, I told you to turn left. Well, I have to tell you, excuse me for shouting at you, in the intensity of remembering this, the three of us looked at him. We thought he was crazy. We thought, what is this? This man found us here.
Running around the neighborhood.
Incredible. So we actually, and then he went into a tremendous tirade with the young man who was serving us and a woman behind the bar, and he was chastising them so strongly they had already served us. We have no idea what this all meant. Except that we found out later this was an adjunctive coffee shop to the building we'd been in. Now, he really didn't want us to be served in this operation. He really didn't. I cannot tell you why. Ken Linge is Italian. Stuart could pass for Italian. I'm not necessarily that obvious. We certainly are Americans. They could tell by our speech and our accent. But there was no overt reason for this tirade. Stuart and Ken, with a wonderful sense of humor, for weeks after that, when we'd see each other, we would say, I told you to turn left. It became a fucking line. However, we went from there to Hanover, and again we were at an afternoon garden reception, and I told the American envoy in Hanover, Germany about this. Now, there's been a very strong neo-Nazi movement in Hanover. Even then it existed. I guess it's gotten worse. If we had had the time, I would have pursued this in Stuttgart. And if it wasn't a weekend, I think this was a Saturday, because it was Sunday that we had this garden reception. And I told a group of people this story, Germans. They were horrified. They said, what did you do about it? I said, it's a Saturday. There is absolutely no way of handling this on Saturday. And, excuse me. And I would have tried to go to, I don't know, the city county building or where. There was, even if it was anti-Americanism, there was no excuse for this tirade and this outburst. And the envoy was very disturbed about it. I don't know whether he ever got back to anybody in Stuttgart or not. Just an interesting kind of an unpleasantness. In Berlin, we saw a trip. The first time we got to West Berlin, which was in the, mid to late 70s, we saw a tremendous amount of decadence. We saw a tremendous amount of drug usage. We saw all kinds, especially among adolescents and young people, alcoholism, excessive alcoholism. We saw that in Stuttgart and in Frankfurt. A great many disenchanted, disenfranchised young people. Whether they were the roots of all the difficulty, we can't say. Most of the time, what we had was the elegant society patrons of the arts who support foreign orchestras on their surf, and very elegant people who were gracious and cordial because we were there as VIPs. Fascinating experiences.
Thank you. How long did your husband do this?
We were with the symphony. Paul was in this capacity for 18 years, trips.
Oh, wow.
9 trips. His last tour of duty was in 1989 with the trip that began in Russia and then went on to Poland. Mm-hmm. And he could write a book himself about some of his experiences, incredible experiences, all over the world. All over. In most instances, the only place he couldn't get the kind of laboratory care and x-ray service he needed, interestingly enough, was in Germany one year when the timpanist developed acute gastric symptoms, and another player, a woman who had just had a baby who had an unbalanced thyroid condition, her doctor said, oh, Paul will take care of you on the trip, which wasn't very fair because he didn't have the facilities of a lab and so forth. There were 3 people who needed care, for kind of acute care, requiring a hospital or the facilities of a lab and an x-ray department and so forth. So Paul called the American Army Base Hospital in Germany and was rebuffed. He couldn't get it. They only would take families of servicemen. Paul said, look, this is how I'm here. It's a tour of duty. We're leaving tomorrow. These 3 people need immediate attention. And Captain so-and-so, if you can't call me, I'm calling my congressman and I'm calling the head of this base. An hour later, they were received and got the service. And that's not like Paul. He's really very gentle and laid back. Yeah. He had to be very authoritative to get the care he needed. We had a funny experience in...
Why do you think that they didn't share the...
Well, they don't want to establish a pattern. The bases are really...
No, even among the hospitals in Germany. You couldn't use any of the hospitals?
He probably could have, but it seemed so obvious that this would be, after all, an American installation, you know. Actually, you make a good point, Shirley, because in Hong Kong, Paul had to hospitalize patients twice, and Before we went to any of these countries, he researched the hospitals where English was spoken, where he would get the best care. And the Seventh-day Adventist Hospital had the most Western-trained and Western kind of medicine. And they were wonderful to him. And again, this happened on a Saturday when one of the men developed acute pancreatitis. And this is a funny story, too. I'll give you a little vignette that has humor. Paul immediately got Ben into the hospital, and the lab was closed, but they called the laboratory physician and technician and literally gave him a staff appointment in record time. They couldn't have been nicer. And the young man, in fact, who came in to do x-rays and to verify the diagnosis was trained in America. So even though he was an Englishman, but he had been trained in America. So that worked very well. We had, however, the funniest experience. The one thing this man, who was hospitalized on intravenous for 4 or 5 days, what he was most worried about is he had ordered a suit from a Hong Kong tailor, and he was supposed to have a fitting in our hotel. So he was worried about this. Paul said, just don't you worry about it. So Paul and I went into the shop, and we told the tailor of this extreme circumstance. He said not to worry, and we took him with the suit to the hospital, and he fitted the suit right there in the hospital, and it was ready when we left. It was wonderful. Yeah. Oh, we've had so many funny stories. I just thought of a wonder. Oh, so many funny stories. I really could write a book. Didn't I tell you about China and the ambassador of culture? Was that not on the tape?
You mentioned...
When we arrived in Beijing? No. In Beijing, the Minister of Culture, the luggage?
Shopping cart.
Yeah.
Yes, you did.
That story you have. We've just had so many wonderful vignettes. I don't want to labor it, however.
That's why at the end of the last interview I asked you, and you elaborated on some more stories, and they're just wonderful. If there's any others that you would like to recall?
Well, I'm just wondering if there's anything that's particularly relates to Judaism.
I was just going to ask you, did you visit any of the Jewish communities in these places that you went to?
We went in Amsterdam, yes. We spent the whole day at the Jewish Museum. Oh, I'm glad you reminded me of that. Heavens, yes. And in Russia, we went to we went to the Great Synagogue that had been on our own. This is very, very interesting. The Jewish Museum in Amsterdam is a recent new building on the site of several small... Did I say museum? That's correct.
Yes.
The site of several small synagogues which merged. There was an Orthodox, and adjacent to it was a conservative. I don't know that they had a reform. But they saw the need to amalgamate all this. There isn't that much of a community. And they put it all under one wonderful roof. Mm. And you do have the artifacts from the 18th century, 17th and 18th century Jewish community. Did I tell you about our visit to Dachau when we were in Munich?
No.
Oh, dear. Well, that's a story. We have time.
Surely.
Five of us wanted to go to Dachau on a Sunday when we arrived in Munich. And we went to the concierge in the hotel, and we said, what's the best way to get there? He pointed to a woman who was a travel agent, a German travel agent, and he said, ask her. So we went to this lady who spoke excellent English, and she said to us, why do you want to go to Dachau? Why don't you go to the countryside instead? It's so lovely today. Why don't you stay? No, we said, we're going to Dachau. Well, she said, the subway is very close. That's the best way to go. And she proceeded to give us directions. We get into the subway station. Everything is electronic. There isn't a soul. You push buttons for your ticket. It indicates the stop. It indicates the marvelously technologically ahead of our time. And as we're standing there trying to read it and fathom it, an elderly gentleman comes over and he said, may I help you? We tell him we're on our way to Dachau and we haven't quite figured out which buttons we press for our 5 tickets. He says, what were you doing? And we tell her what she told us. He said, you know, those are exactly the wrong information. You will be going south to the countryside instead of Dachau. She deliberately gave us the wrong directions.
Oh,
yes. So he pressed the information for us, and really it's only about 20 minutes away by subway and elevated L. And we spent the day in Dachau. In fact, we sat out a sudden rainstorm in a crematorium. Hmm. Now, we had an experience there. They have torn down most of the barracks. They've left the rubble of one to show you where the barracks existed. The slit trench where they threw people and killed them still exists. I can't believe after all this time I still have that mental image. The crematoria, they exist. By the way, this was an international committee that was created in 1964 to put this into this condition. And there is a monument indicating that. And there are inter-religious monuments denoting the different religions who perished. When we went into the building which houses the museum with tremendous numbers of pictures, photographs, the usual memorabilia that you've seen at Yad Vashem, you know, the clothing, the glasses, the shoes, the hair, the whole tragic bit. On the wall, which is a huge wall you face as you enter, it has to be, the wall has to be 18 feet wide. And on that wall was a map with pins indicating where all the camps were, all the concentration camps. Now, you know, we know the main names, the Bergen-Belsen and the Auschwitz, Munich.